The summer season had just opened, and Karen and I were the only guests at a little hotel on Turkey's Bodrum Peninsula. At dinner that evening, the manager came to us rather sheepishly and said, "There's a village wedding happening in an empty lot just beside our property. It's the seventh and final night of the wedding celebrations, and it's going to be very noisy, with lots of music and dancing, and you won't be able to fall asleep until it's over at midnight. So would you like to go to the wedding?" We thought for a moment and thought, well, we can't sleep anyway. Sure. So at 10 p.m., we met her at the gate going out of the property, and she escorted us to this wedding where they had reserved two seats for us. And for the next 2 hours, we enjoyed the rhythmic Turkish music, the tremendous dancing, and the people so at home in their bodies, the celebration of an entire village. The wedding dress looked pretty worn and tattered by now after 7 days of dancing, but that did not hinder anyway the joy and satisfaction that they were experiencing together. And it reminded us a little bit of the Middle Eastern weddings in biblical days, when they would gather for 7 days at the groom's household and have a great party. And yes, it's possible in that long period of time that the wine might run out, especially if some unexpected thirsty guests like Jesus and his disciples might show up. Here we are in the second Sunday after the Epiphany, and the lectionary takes us every 3 years to this story of the wedding in Cana. I've been here now 15 years, and I think I've heard at least 4 sermons on changing water into wine. Even so, with all the preaching that we've received, there are all kinds of mysteries and troubles with this passage that I cannot really fully resolve, that still remain in tension. First of all, why did Jesus' mother ask Jesus to intervene in the first place? How did she know that he had special powers? And what do we make of Jesus' rather rude-sounding response, which in the NRSV sounds even more rude? "Woman, what concern is of it to you or me?" And what do we make of Jesus saying, "My hour has not yet come"? Because just in a few minutes, he starts to act and do what is needed anyway. So did he change his mind? And what was he talking about with this hour that was supposed to come? And then why did he produce such an insane amount of wine? 150 gallons. What did they do with the excess? Did they sell it off and buy a condo on Capernaum or something? I don't know what the couple. The commentators go bananas over these questions. And alas, I don't have any really good answers either. There's some mystery to this story. How do you envision this taking place? You have in hand two very different paintings of this story, and I hope all of you got that. If you didn't, just make your way out to the entrance there and grab one, because you're going to need this to follow along with my sermon. The first one is from the Vue de Jésus Ma Foi project in Cameroon, because so much of Christian art is very Western. There was an attempt, a project made to develop some authentic African interpretations. So villagers in northern Cameroon were asked to act out a number of biblical stories. Photographs were taken, and then paintings were made of those photographs. And so these gospel stories came alive in these particular villages. So that's where this project comes from. The Cameroonian version is a very informal village scene. The bride and groom are humbly dressed and seated under a special canopy. There are musicians there with their instruments. And the scene takes place just as the wine is running dry. The central figure in the painting is the mother of Jesus, who, by the way, is never mentioned by name in the Gospel of John. It's always Jesus' mother. She stands before her son with her arms outstretched, almost as though she's interceding on behalf of the marrying couple, the couple that was in distress. Now, Cana was only a 7-kilometer walk from Nazareth, so quite possibly Jesus' family was related to one of the bridal party. And she is moved with compassion to try to salvage what could have become a very shameful disaster for the couple. Now, those of us in North America can't quite appreciate the enormity of the command to fill those water jars. It wasn't just a matter of finding a hose and filling them up. In an African village, in a Middle Eastern village, maybe there was a well, and it would have taken quite a few trips to that well to bring 150 gallons worth of water, or it was dry season, as this painting seems to indicate in the African setting, and in dry season, many times they'd have to go to a stream far away from the village to carry that water. So what an incredible assignment Jesus gives to those servants. Mary is a very beloved figure in African spirituality. The Nigerian Jesuit theologian Agbonpiagbege Orobator has written a beautiful book called A Theology Brewed in an African Pot. He has a chapter on Mary, the Mother of Sorrows. And in that chapter, he reflects on why Mary has such a special place in the hearts, especially of rural African women. Because like so many rural African women, she gave birth in difficult, unusual circumstances. Like so many African rural women, she had to flee from a despotic ruler, flee for her life, and become a refugee in another country. And like so many rural African women, she watched her child die. African women take heart in that someone like Mary understands their plight. Mary, the Mother of Sorrows. Flip that painting around, and there's a stark contrast to the African setting. Paolo Veronese makes lavish use of colors and architectural majesty and glittering pageantry. The wedding at Cana was painted in 1563 as a contract to fill an entire wall of a Benedictine monastery's dining hall. And so this painting is massive. It's 10 meters wide by almost 7 meters high, filling this entire wall. It's huge. There are over 130 portraits in the painting. So it's shrunk down so small that I know it's hard for you to even distinguish the various characters on there. When Veronese was asked about the 130 people on his canvas, he could identify each one by name and what their role was at the wedding, including some historic kings and queens from Europe who show up in the painting. None of the people are speaking in the painting because the Benedictines observed silence during their meals. And so all these folks at this wedding are mute. It's a bit like a Where's Waldo picture. Can you spot the elegant woman daintily cleaning her teeth with a toothpick over on the left side? Or the other woman who's urging her husband to ask the bride about the new red wine that they have just been served? The bride and the groom on the far left of the table are dressed in all the finery of typical 16th century Venice. There's a jester behind them, which makes this clearly a non-Jewish event. And then there's an hourglass positioned directly below Jesus on a table. surrounded by the instrumentalists. His words, "My hour has not yet come," made to refer to his coming death and sacrifice. The musicians in the foreground are playing instruments typical of the 16th century Europe, and their appearances are remarkably similar to many of the painters that were peers to Veronese. And he himself puts himself as his self-portrait as the one playing the viola right there in the center in the bottom. The painting hung in the monastery in Venice for 235 years until it was plundered by Napoleon in 1797. He cut it in half, put it in one of his big wagons, and carted it off to France, where it remained ever since. Today, of course, they stitched it. They were able to splice it back together. Today, it hangs in the Louvre, the largest painting in that museum. It's an oil on wood with a massive frame. It weighs 1.5 tons. No art thief is going to attempt to remove it. But it's one of the most neglected and unseen paintings in the Louvre. Why is that? How many of you have been to see the Mona Lisa? Raise your hand. Quite a few of you. I did it in 1977. We all had our backs to this painting. My daughter took a picture. It's quite hilarious. She's standing facing the painting, and all the people are facing Mona Lisa with their cameras and their phones up in the air, taking a picture of Mona Lisa, and everybody's got their backs to Veronese's painting. Thousands of people have streamed through without noticing. Jesus and his mother in this painting are smack in the middle, the guests of honor. They're dressed in first century garb of simple Galileans. Veronese has displaced the bride and groom, put them off to the side instead of at the typical head table position, and put Jesus there. And at his right and left are some of the apostles, reminiscent of the Last Supper, where Jesus once again would take wine, but this time take wine to point to his death and his sacrifice on behalf of the world. Above Jesus, on the balcony, some men are butchering an animal that is not in clear view. Art critics have suggested that it's a lamb, prefiguring the future sacrifice of Jesus. The man striking the knife is directly above Jesus' head. Toward the bottom right, there's a man pouring wine from a large ornate jug. A cat clings to the unused water jug. A number of healthy dogs are present too. And next to him stands the steward, a man studying the glass of wine. He's the host, or master of ceremonies, responsible to make sure everything goes well. This is a key story of the season of Epiphany. This year it will be a long season, from January 6th till March 5th, when Ash Wednesday comes around. A focus in which the church emphasizes the revealing glory of Christ ever in greater measures throughout the stories of the gospel. John ends his narrative by saying, "Jesus did this, the first of his signs, in Cana of Galilee, and revealed his glory, and the disciples put their faith in him." John's gospel emphasizes the extravagant ways Jesus expresses the grace of the Father, the provisions, the 900 bottles of wine, the 153 fish caught in the net in John chapter 21, the bread and fish for a multitude that result in 12 baskets left over. The miracle is rather frivolous considering all the great needs of the world, the despair, the disease, the hunger. It's not a life or death situation. Nobody is sick and needs healing. It's just a wedding. an awkward social situation, an embarrassment for the steward, perhaps a stigma the couple might have to bear for the rest of their lives for being that couple that did not plan well for their wedding reception. In Dostoevsky's novel, Brothers Karamazov, there's a chapter entitled Cana of Galilee. And for the main character of Dostoevsky's novel, Alyosha, the story represents an important theme of the spiritual life. The fact that Jesus was willing to share in and continue the joy of a wedding banquet. In some ways, it indicates his willingness to participate in all of the human experience, from his deepest griefs and pains and sorrow to his deepest joys, the highest moments of celebration. Alyosha is a novice monk who finds himself imaginatively meditating on this story, and pardon his gender-exclusive language, exclaims, "Ah, that miracle! Ah, that sweet miracle! It was not men's grief, but their joy that Christ visited. He worked his first miracle to help men's gladness. He who loves men loves their gladness too." The past few days, Karen and I have had heavy hearts over the devastation of the fires in Los Angeles County, where we spent some very precious years of our lives. Our beloved church, Altadena Baptist Church, a rare, egalitarian, interracial, affirming Baptist church, was completely destroyed, and many of its congregants lost their homes. The fires left a massive landscape of destruction wherever the flames went, an aftermath of trauma, grief, and pain. And Jesus entered that kind of a world of oppression, of disease, of marginalization, and despair. And wherever he went, people broke out in celebration. At Cana, a widow received back to life her son who had passed away suddenly. The blind were able to see. The lame were leaping and praising God. Lepers were restored to health and to community. It's like a whirlwind of joy followed him wherever he went, and people erupted into praise. He created an aftermath of joy wherever he showed up. Alyosha got it right. He who loves people loves their gladness too. John 15:11, Jesus said, "I have told you these things that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete." So scratch your head, folks. Does it surprise you that followers of Jesus have become such a dour bunch? Sometimes the church has forgotten to live out the joy of the one who loves to hear people's laughter. To paraphrase David Steele, blessed is the church that has a real tenor and a real plumber. But doubly blessed is the church that has people that can throw really good parties, who understand Cana grace. The feast at Cana unveils a God who rejoices as the bridegroom rejoices over the bride. It should lead us to toast the world with the amazing good news of extravagant grace.